You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Hello and welcome back to the Everything is Black and White podcast. This is part two of the latest episode of Gibbo's Corner, where John has picked the greatest ever number sevens of Newcastle United. Hopefully you guys have tuned in for part one and you've enjoyed it. You've had a bit of debate with your friends and family about it. Well, here is part two. Who will be top of the list? Let's get on with the show. On to number four then, John. We've got a fella who's been mentioned already in passing. He was part of the FA Cup winning sides, won two FA Cups. And, you know, he is number, what number is he in my list? 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. He's number six in my list. He's number four in your list, and it is Tommy Walker, who played for Newcastle between 1941 and 1954. So, you know, number four, just outside of the medal ranking, if you were doing it in Greg Rutherford style Olympics. Number four, why does he just miss out on that top three?
Yeah. Well, he was the outside right in 1951 and 1952 FA Cup final successes at Wembley, which is quite something when it comes to medals. He was born in Ashwinning, but he was brought up in Cramlington, so very much a local lad. And as I mentioned when I was talking about previous players, Newcastle like to have the balance between a quick winger on one side and a tricky winger on the other. And originally the quick one was Tommy Walker in 51-52 with Mitchell on the other side. I mean, interesting side things about him. He was a Methodist lay preacher at one time, which is... slightly unusual, perhaps, for a footballer, although I don't see why it should be unusual, but it is. He was a Methodist lay preacher at one time, and he took part in several sprint handicaps as a teenager. That's how quick he was, including the famous Powder Hall meeting in Edinburgh, which is where the Powder Hall sprints, which were hugely, hugely, hugely famous back in the 50s, and why Jackie Milburn took part in them as well. There were handicap sprints. You know, you give a certain start to some of the opposition, et cetera, et cetera. And you had to be professional. If you ran in them, you could no longer be an amateur because you got prize money. You got dough stuck in your back pocket for winning it or finish second or finish third. So you were a professional. Now, if you're a footballer, you're a professional anyway, so you run in the sprints. You can't run in the Olympics or in the Commonwealth Games because you're a professional. And he was, Tommy, he was 16 when he started playing, and he was working in an insurance office in Blyth. And the amazing thing is he began his career as a centre-half during wartime football, as a centre-half, but was converted to play as a pacey winger because he was quick. In those days, centre-half didn't need to be quick. But when he was quick, if you're going to fully utilise it, they stuck him out on the wing. And the interesting thing, I like, what I find wonderful is the contrast between football, say in the 50s, and football as we know it today. And for the younger people that know the football today, how about this? When Walker, when Newcastle won the Cup 3 times in 5 years in the beginning of the 50s, which is the last time we've won the FA Cup, was then. Can you imagine, before the final, I worked with Jackie, and Jackie told me this story years later. Before the fight, that first final in 1951, which Jackie played in and Tommy Walker played in, the likes of Jackie, Tommy Walker, Mitch, Joe Harvey, they brought out a brochure and they put trestle tables up in the car park at St. James's Park, and they put the brochures on the trestle tables, and the players went out into the car park a couple of hours before the match and sold the brochures to the fans, and that was Newcastle United allowed them to do that, and that money was theirs. So that's how they made the money to appear in the final. I was talking to Jackie, he said, and the trouble was, he said, when the punters come up and bought a brochure, they then wanted to chat to him. We start chatting to them about the team and what would happen that afternoon. He said, we sold half as many. We could have sold twice as many if we'd stopped talking and just sold it, the talk to everybody. And then by coming up to 2:30, the manager come out on the top and shouted to them, right, lads, in. And they come in, got changed and ran out on the pitch. They stood with the crowd that was going to watch them flogging brochures to the crowd, and then played the game, and then went down to Wembley and won the cup. I mean, it's good. And on that theme, I know, because the difference the pennies made in those days and what is capable of making today, and I had to get money out of little things like doing that with the trestles. And Jackie Milburn told me this story as well, Gibby. He said, imagine this, he said, after we won the cup, we had a celebration dance at the Oxford Galleries, which is in this centre of town. It no longer exists, but it was in the centre of town. He says, and we were told that that our wives were going to be each presented with a handbag, you know, by the board of directors. And they thought, because they'd been talking to other people, other players elsewhere in the country who got illegal payments, no names, no pactfuls. Newcastle didn't, but other players got money they shouldn't have got, and et cetera, et cetera. And that made Newcastle players a little bit jealous because they were living on peanuts, and they were getting the local bus into training and that sort of thing on every day of the week. He said, a rumour went round the lads that these handbags were going to have a few pound notes in them. And the player said, terrific, looking forward to this, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, sure enough, when one of the players went up, it was George Hannah's wife that went up, and she got her bag presented to her on the stage, and she was walking out, and the handle on the bag snapped, and the bag fell on the floor. And the player said, hey, look at that. It's so full of flipping money. The handle snapped. And the bush got the bag, opened it, and it was stuffed with the Evening Chronicle. There was no money in it to keep it shaped. And not only were they deflated, that they hadn't made something Joe Harvey's famous phrase, so it can go out and buy the Ben a pair of shoes. That's what he used to say. Whenever he put the ball under his arm and led Newcastle out for a game, he used to say, right, lads, time to buy the Bain a pair of shoes. And that meant win the game, and they got 2 and 6 months or something as a win bonus. And he said, what added insult to injury, Jackie told me, he said, what we found out afterwards, that the club had bought a job lot of 30 handbags for 17 quid, and told them out to all the players' wives. So that was the way our superstars, our last players to win the FA Cup in the history of this club, that's the way they lived.
Yeah, a fantastic contrast. And Of course, as we've just said there, Tommy Walker, part of that famous FA Cup winning side in the early 50s. He is number four in John's top 10 number sevens of Newcastle United.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
On to number three then, and we've got a man with silverware at Newcastle United, a man who was part of the last side to win a major honour at Newcastle United. Of course, that's the old Fairs Cup. And it's Jim Scott in at number three. Some people will be aware of him, John. How does he break into your top three?
Yeah. And he played as an orthodox outside right, because in those days it was before squad numbers. And he was Newcastle's outside right. He had two exceptional seasons with us. In his first season, 1967-68, was the season we qualified for Europe, which was our first time in Europe, by the way, we remember that. And in 1968-69, we actually won the trophy, the European Fairs Cup. So he had a significant part in two huge seasons. And as I'll come to in a minute, he did a lot of firsts in his short time here. Well, for example, he had a knack of scoring historic goals for us. He scored Newcastle's first ever goal in Europe competition when he scored the first goal against Feyenoord at St James's Park when Newcastle won 4-0. So he was the first ever goal scorer in European competition. In the semi-final against Rangers, he scored, which put us in the final. And in the final against Budapest, he scored. And he, again, I reiterate, he was an outside right, not a centre forward. And you've got to remember, the amazing thing is, in the semi-final, we played Rangers twice. And in the final, we played Budapest twice. And both our strikers, Wyn Davies and Pop Robson, who we relied on hugely, didn't score in any of those four games. Quite amazing, isn't it? That the centre forward and the man that played on his shoulder didn't score in those four games. And Jim Smith, our outside right, scored in the semi-final and in the final. And that's how well he did for Newcastle. He was the typical Scottish winger, you know. People would say, and they didn't mean it as an insult, he was a fancy Dan. He was a tanner ball player. That's what they used to say in those days. In other words, he had great feet. He almost looked as if he danced. He was so light on his feet, he looked as if he danced. I swear that there was no mark in the mud. There was no footprint in the mud because he just tiptoed over the top of the mud. And he had great feet and he did terrific. And he was a great, great personal friend of our other winger on the other side, our outside left, Jackie Sinclair. They all their lives and their lives after they stopped playing, they remained great friends. And I had a bit of fun with him after the semi-final, because if you remember, we drew 0-0 at Rangers when Willie McFall, in the semi-final, Glasgow Rangers, when Willie McFall saved a penalty. And we beat Rangers in the second leg down here 2-0. And when the second goal went in, all the Rangers fans rioted and charged onto the pitch and the game was nearly abandoned. And I always laughed and had a joke with Scotty and with Little Jaggy that it took two jocks to start the jocks off writing, because, of course, they were two Scottish lads and they scored the two goals that beat Rangers. And once Rangers knew they'd lost, the fans streamed on the pitch, hoping that the game would be abandoned, would have to be replayed, and might be different. Although, to the eternal credit of Glasgow Rangers, their chairman, while we were off the pitch for however long it took to clear, went straight into the Newcastle dressing room and said, "Gentlemen," there was only 10 minutes to go over, "Gentlemen, whatever happens, you're through to the final. We will sacrifice the game if need be, because it's our fans that have come on and started the riot." The terrible thing with Jackie is Jackie Sinclair, and it hit Jim Scott very, very badly. Later on, after they retired, he was struck down by cancer. It decimated him. He was so brave about it. He knew it was terminal. He wanted it to come out because he wanted Newcastle fans to know what was wrong with him and why he wasn't attending one or two First Cup reunions on Tyneside, and because he loved the fans so much. And he asked me if I would tell the story, and it was one of the hardest interviews I've done, was to interview Jack about when you're talking to somebody and he's talking about dying and this, the knowledge that he is going to die. And it was such a hard, hard interview to do. But it worked, and it decimated Jim Scott when Jackie died, because they were so, so close. But there we go. On a much more lighthearted note, the fun thing was we played Real Zaragoza on New Year's Day. Can you imagine playing in Europe and in a top European game on New Year's Day? Not the day before or the day after, on New Year's Day. And I remember it ever so well, because I drove the car. I mean, it was just getting light in the morning. It was so early. Drove the car into St. James's Park, and there was my car to fly with Newcastle United on the plane. There was 6 inches of snow on the ground, and it was beginning to melt, and it had become slush. And, you know, the conditions were horrendous. Squadron leader James Rush, who was the director of Newcastle, and had been a squadron leader and loved still to be called, although retired, squadron leader. He wasn't called Mr. Rush, he was called Squadron Leader Rush. He arrived at Newcastle at the St. James's Park to announce that the Newcastle airport had been closed. And our chartered Viscount plane had been diverted to Middleton St. George Airport, which is further down through Down. And we were going to have to go down there to be able to fly, get out of Newcastle for the game. Sure enough, we flew way over the Pyrenees down into Zaragoza, which is a cathedral city in northern Spain. Now, we're playing on New Year's Day. So New Year's Eve, we're spending in a hotel in Spain. And there was a Spanish First Division side called Granada who was staying in the hotel with us. And, of course, they weren't playing the next day. So they were out, and they'd bought Beatles wigs. Beatles were the big things in those days, of course. And they had the Beatle wigs on, and they were chanting Newcastle, Newcastle, because all the press lads had stayed up, naturally, to see the new year. And Joe Harvey, they have a thing out in Spain, Ceremony of the Grapes, which is at 12 midnight, the grapes, you have a drink, etc. Joe knew the lads wouldn't be able to get to sleep, the players, because of the racket going on. So he allowed them to come downstairs. Imagine this before a European game. They came downstairs for midnight, and they were kicking off at lunchtime the next day. For midnight, they have a little glass of white wine and toast and say, "Happy New Year." And then he had them away upstairs, and we partied the rest of the night away. Inevitably, we lost the game the next day, but it wasn't quite so inevitable, because we did well. We only lost 3-2. And it's the only time, Andrew, in the whole of that European campaign, that we had to rely on away goals to get us through. We always beat the side on aggregate over two legs all the way through the competition, bar Real Zaragoza, who we lost 3-2 out there. We won 1-0 at St. James's Park, which made it 3-3. But we'd scored the two away goals, so we got through on away goals. It was our toughest game of the lot. The fun started after the game, which is why this comes into the Jim Scott story. After the game, I'm upstairs in my hotel room, busy in those days, again, so different from today, on a typewriter, typing my stuff out, going to ad-lib it over the phone to back to the Chronicle offices in Newcastle. I suddenly get a tip off on the phone that there's a commotion downstairs in the hotel in the lawyer, and I might like to go down and see what it's all about. So I lash downstairs. There's a couple of burly cops in the foyer with guns strapped on their hips, and they're in agitated conversation with Jim Scott and Dave Smith. Dave Smith was our coach in the first couple years. And they're in agitated conversation with him. I go across, say, can I help, what's up? And they said, can you get the interpreter? And can you get our interpreter down? We had an interpreter on the trip with us. He come downstairs, talked to the police, had him get the passports of Jim Scott and Dave Smith, which the police looked at. It turned out the two Englishmen called Scott and Smith, common a name is that. There was two Englishmen called Scott and Smith had absconded from custody of the Spanish police, and they got the tip off that they were in this hotel, and they come this hotel to arrest them. And of course, when they got the passports and that, it was all taken care of. And Jim Scott said to me, I tell you what, Dibbo, he said, it blinking sickens me. He says, you know, two canny Scots are taking the rap because two Englishmen have fooled the coppers, sort of thing. But of course, upstairs I go, get me match report over, and what do I get out of it? Page one story, United pay and police swoop. And I did the story about how the cops come with guns to arrest Jim Scott and Dave Smith. Fun stories, didn't do anybody's enemies harm. But Jim Scott has remained so much in love with Newcastle United, and with that time, and there's a Fairs Club down here, which you've heard of, I think, Andrew, I'm president of it, which was formed by supporters to recognise our first ever achievement in Europe. And he comes down for a lot of those dues. One of the things that virtually nobody knows is that Jim and his lovely lady wife lost a son while he was a player at Newcastle, virtually at birth. And he is buried down here, and they come down here and visit the grave whenever they're at Newcastle. He's got a huge tie to this area. And he was very much a footballing family again, like we've had the Charltons and we've had the Rutherfords that we talked about and the Milburns. I mean, Jim Scott's father played for Falkirk and Burnley. His brother, Alex, was the very, very famous player that was in the great Glasgow Rangers side. He played for Everton as well. He came down to England and was capped by Scotland, as Jim Scott was. And once he retired from football, Jim, and was back up in Scotland, he and Alex, his brother, ran a pub up there for a while. And it was quite a place with their shirts on the wall and their Scotland caps together. And he's still with us today, is Jim, and he's a lovely, gentle man that is very much part of Newcastle's history and very proud to have been part of the history. And so that's why he's in my so high up in my side.
A worthy placement at number three in the list of the greatest number sevens at Newcastle United. And on to now the final two names then. And this man that is number two in the list, needs no introduction. Many of you will have him as your number one, but he does make it onto number two on John's list. I've got him at number three. And ladies and gents, it is Kevin Keegan. John, like I say, many would have him at number one. You've gone for number two. Do you want to kind of just share why he doesn't quite get the top spot?
Yeah.
Number two is not a bad place to be.
I mean, Kevin Keegan changed the whole history of Newcastle United, not once, but twice, because he got them back up and out of the doldrums when he was a player. And then we all know what he did as a manager with the entertainers, etc. And the only reason why he didn't make one for me, and by the way, it's between him and Dalglish, who makes one for Liverpool, because they were the two huge number sevens at Liverpool. The only reason he is up there so high because of the influence he had on Newcastle, but his two seasons here, and it was only two seasons, were both in the second division. They weren't in the top flight. He retired at Newcastle, the way he swan song at Newcastle. So it's very hard when all these other people did all these other things in the top flight to put somebody that only was here two seasons and neither were in the top flight as your number one. But nobody had a greater influence on Newcastle United than Kevin Keegan. And I'm talking about Kevin Keegan, the player. Forget as a manager, because you've got to remember that when he'd come, we were going nowhere fast. I mean, we were down in the second division without hope. The rest of the country were taking absolutely no notice of us. The bank manager was frowning because we were skint. We weren't making any money. We were the original drifters. We were literally drifting. On the other hand, Kevin Keegan was the England captain. He was twice European Footballer of the Year, European Cup winner with Liverpool. He's destroyer of Newcastle in the 74 Cup final, if you remember. And, I mean, it was phenomenal the way that Newcastle were turned around by the foresight of deciding to go for this guy. Arthur Cox, who knew that Newcastle needed to be revived and that it was a sleeping giant, but it wasn't just asleep. It was comatose. It was almost dead. And it had to be woke up. A year before he did the deal, he took Harry Swales out for lunch. Harry Swales was the agent for Kevin Keegan. And when I was with Kevin Keegan a couple of weeks back, I said to him, you know, Harry, nobody had an agent in those days. And he said, yeah, in fact, he said, you're right. He said, but actually, I was the second player to have an agent. He said, George Best was the first player that had an agent, and I was the second, and I had Harry Swales. And Arthur had took Harry Swales out for lunch and said, I know that Kevin's contract at Southampton is starting to run down. If he gets a free transfer in the end, I would love to sign him, because Newcastle was skint. I would love to sign him, etc., etc. And that so impressed Kevin Keegan that when we went in for him, that we'd done all that homework, that he was thinking along our lines. The way we got him is that we learned, he has a unique thing as well. He had an agent. He also had a release clause in his contract. Everybody has a release clause in their contract now. They didn't know this. But when he signed for Southampton, he insisted on a clause that if anybody was willing to pay £100,000, they couldn't stop him going. Newcastle knew of that and decided, we can afford £100,000. Crikey me, we'll get that on the first gate when he makes his debut. What they couldn't afford was his wages, because at that time he was England captain. And so they got around the problem of the wages in rather a unique way, in a brilliant way. Their major sponsor was the Newcastle Breweries, of which Alistair Wilson was the top hitter in there, who was a lovely man and worked very closely with Newcastle United. And what they decided to do was that Newcastle would offer a wage to Kevin Keegan, and Newcastle Breweries, who they took with them to London for the talks with Keegan, would match that wage for him to work for the Breweries. In other words, you put the two wages together and they were huge. But Newcastle were only paying half of them and the Breweries were paying the other half. Now, the problem then was that Kevin Keegan was teetotal and he wouldn't be pictured with a pint in his hand. So how's he going to work for Newcastle Breweries? Well, they accepted that was the way it was, but he would do talk-ins round there, only exclusively in their social clubs round the area, say once a week, one a week. And the wonderful thing was the Brewers come to me and negotiated with me to do the talks with Keegan. So I was the guy that took Keegan on stage every game. Never got away from the club before midnight. We finished on stage at 10 o'clock. Then he sat on the edge of the stage, made all the fans line up in a long snake. And Noel comes, shook his hand, got his autograph, got a picture taken with him. And he had a chat with him, and he wouldn't leave until the last one was done. I'm not particularly going to tell the story because the greatest exclusive I got ever probably was that Keegan was signed for Newcastle. And it was my friendship with Larry McManamy, who was manager of Southampton at the time, and phoned me from Amsterdam Airport to tell me what plane Kevin was on. He'd had to play out there because they were playing Utrecht, and the club got £15,000, but only if Kevin played. So he had to play. And so we got the exclusive story, page one. We knew what time he'd get in. And, I mean, the date, the great unveiling, August the 19th, 1982, Gosford Park Hotel, 6:30. And that was the press conference that was called. And Russell Cushing, who was the secretary, walked out on stage and said, "We're in heaven, we've got Kevin." Now, honestly, it was so cheesy, and it was so un-Russell Cushing-like, and it was so rehearsed as to not be true, but somehow it caught the mood of everything, because Newcastle as a city were in heaven because we'd got Kevin. And KK, you know, he is the best PR man I have ever known in my life. And in the main, the best PR man for himself, because Newcastle benefited. He was promoting Kevin Keegan, but Newcastle benefited on the side effect of it. And what does he do when he signs for Newcastle? And he's caused chaos. And I mean, he's such a huge profile, signed for a club which was dead on his feet. But what's he do? He gets up and announces, which nobody knew, that his dad was a Geordie and his granddad was one of the heroes of the Stanley Pitt disaster about 50, 60, 70 years earlier. So all of a sudden, he's one of our own. And Kevin turns out to be an adopted Geordie. And so the PR, I mean, the media, the next day, I remember after that press conference, 6:30, I remember being at St. James's Park the next day, and the crowds that were trying to buy season tickets, they couldn't give away season tickets, by the way, before Keegan signed. I mean, they were trying to put them in people's top pocket, and they were saying, "Get off, I'm not coming to St. James's Park to watch that cross." And all of a sudden, there was queues snaking around twice around St. James's Park to buy papers. And I was standing there watching, doing a little report for the Chronicle about this Keegan mania. And all of a sudden, this car drives up the hill into St. James's Park, and it's the chairman, Stan Seymour Jr., who was the son of the famous one that played in the 27 side. And he was so thrilled at seeing this, because they'd taken a huge financial gamble, even on paying half the wage, and so thrilled at seeing all these tickets being, that he put the anchors on the car, jumped out of the car to wave to the crowd, the belt on his trousers caught on the steering wheel, and his pants fell around his ankles. He's standing in the car park, waving to the fans, and funny enough, Kevin brought that. I didn't know Kevin remembered. When I was with him a couple of weeks back, Kevin brought it up to me. He said, "Kippo, can you remember when the chairman was standing with his pants around?" I said, I can't actually. They caught in the wheel, the belt, and he was standing with it. I don't think he minded. He minded too much. He was so thrilled to have Kevin. And when I say he's mastered PR, he's the cleverest guy I've ever known. And everything he did turned it into roses. I mean, he signs for Newcastle. He scores on his debut. We win the match 1-0. A bunch of deadbeats. We're playing QPR. He scores on his debut. 2 years later, he scores on his last game for Newcastle in the promoted. And then he has a testimonial, and he leaves the centre of the pitch at St. James's Park in a helicopter, which rises into the night sky and takes him up to Gosford Park for a big celebration dinner. I mean, you know, that is the king of the top of the pops, isn't it? To have that sort of... I mean, he originally only signed for a year, because he wanted to make certain Newcastle were ambitious. And they were ambitious. He was a Pied Piper. Because he signed for Newcastle, Terry Mack signed for Newcastle, David McCreary signed for Newcastle, Mike Shannon, who was his big horse racing mate, signed on loan for a short while. We ended up with a forward line of Keegan, Waddle and Beardsley, which was quite unique. But he didn't sign for the second year straight away, because we hadn't been in the hunt to go up in the first season, and he wanted some reaction from Newcastle. And what was needed to get the best out of Kevin, we had Imre Vivardi played centre-forward, who was a terrific goal scorer, but not a good footballer. The ball was played over the top of him, he got on his bike, he ran behind defenders, and he stuck the ball on the net, in the net. But his second touch was a tackle. I mean, he didn't have it. He wasn't a beautiful player. And so Arthur Cox decided he had to get somebody in place of Ray, who could hold the ball up, could play with Keegan, could open defenders up with the skill that, that Keegan had. And again, I was reminiscing with Kevin recently about it. And he said, Gibbo, I knew this guy was coming. And he said, Arthur, come in one morning. He said, I've got the guy, Kevin, who will be perfect for you. And he said, who is it, Gaffer? He said, and I was hoping it was Kenny Dalglish. And he said, it's Peter Beardsley. And he says, Peter Beardsley? He says, I've never heard him. Where's he come from? He said, Vancouver Whitecaps. And Kevin Keegan said, what's he doing out in Vancouver? Who is he like? And he said, and then he walked in. And I said, and here's this little guy. He says, he was smaller than me. He says, Peter Beardsley was a little young lad who had never played over here to any extent, just at Carlisle. He says, and he was small like me, and I'd been waiting for Kenny Dalglish. He said, and I thought, oh, dear. He says, and I tell you what, Gibbo, I saw him in the first training session, in the first five-a-side. He said, and I thought, this bloke will do for me. He said, and he was so good, he said. When I become manager, the first thing I did was go and sign him again to play for me when I was manager. He says, that's how good he was. And, you know, we've become a magical side from being a very average side. And on the back of three strikers, Keegan, Beardsley and Waddle, and there wasn't a centre-forward amongst them. None of them was a centre-forward, but each could play so brilliantly. You tot up the number of international caps for England they got. They all got above 50 each. That's how good they were. And they took Newcastle to promotion. And for that, thanks very much, Kevin. And yeah, in my list for that. But by Jove, you'd be in my list for the best managers of Newcastle United as well.
A tremendous talent, 48 goals and 78 appearances. And as John said, they just turned everything around at St. James's Park upon his arrival. But he is beaten to the number one spot by another tremendous servant of the club, someone who spent nearly a decade on Tyneside, someone who still gets up to St. James's Park nowadays and is still loved and adored by fans, someone who really embraced moving here, a southerner. A Londoner. You know, we all know the claim that, you know, Newcastle United fans don't like people from London. Well, this man settled just fine. Your number one, John, is?
Rob Lee. And I think in my book, obviously, thoroughly deserved. I mean, what a wonderful, wonderful player. He came as an outside right, wore the seven shirt, but played centre midfield from then on. And again, I was talking to KK about him, and Kevin said, you know what, he'd played an eternity for Charlton Athletic. He'd lived in the same house, in the same street all his life. He had the same mates, he said, and I felt he needed a change in life. He needed to get away and blossom and become what he was. And funny enough, the fella that tipped off Kevin Keegan originally about Rob Lee was Gavin Peacock. They played for Newcastle and played for KK, because Gavin's dad, Keith, had played for Charlton and was on the the coaching staff of Charlton temporarily managed him at one time. So he knew everything was going off at Charlton. And Gavin said to KK, there's a kid down there you want to have a look at. I think he would do a terrific job for Newcastle. And it was Rob. And of course, the famous quote is that KK convinced Rob that the other side that was in from Middlesbrough, that Newcastle was closer to London than Middlesbrough was in terms of him being able to go home. In fact, it is true, but it's not as stupid as it sounds. He persuaded Rob that Newcastle was easier to get to from London because of direct air flights, et cetera, et cetera, than it was get to Middlesbrough, which was out on a limb somewhere. What he did tell him as well, he said, you sign for me and you'll play for England. And he did play for England 21 times. So he told him the truth there. One of the other things I found out of Rob, why he signed, is that as a kid, Kevin Keegan had been his hero. When Rob was a kid, Kevin Keegan, the player, was his hero. And again, and this is not known really to this day, but like Kevin showed that he was a adopted Geordie by his dad and his granddad in the Stanley Pit disaster, Rob, who was a total Londoner, actually had relatives who took part in the Jarrow March from here to London. He actually had relatives in his family that took part in the Jarrow March. So coming up here meant something to him. And I said to Kevin, why did he say, what was it with Robbie Stone? He said, look, I saw him as very similar to Steve Stone, who, remember, become a coach up here. But Steve Stone played for Nottingham Forest and was the England outside right at the time, he said. And I thought he was very similar to Steve Stone. He beat people, he could score goals, he tracked back. But he said, as I saw him develop, I wanted to use him where he would influence the game more. So I moved him into the centre and midfield. He said, and I said at the time, he was the best midfielder in England, and I still mean it. And he said to me, of all my signings, and if you remember, his signings for the entertainers were fabulous. Ginola, Les Ferdinand, Alan Shearer, Beattie. He says, of all my signings, if I had to pick one out who was the utmost value for money, he says it would be Rob Lee at £700,000. And that is some accolade from Keegan. And I mean, in the 1993 promotion side, Lee was playing as an outside right. As Newcastle began life in the Premier League, he went to centre midfield. He was an England regular from 94 to 98, scored in his debut against Romania. Star man for Newcastle. When they went back into Europe, the first game in 20 years in Europe, they went to Royal Antwerp, won 5-0 in September 1994. Rob Lee scored a hat-trick of headers. If headers, the one thing Rob Lee didn't do was head a ball. He scored a hat-trick of headers. The first was in 50 seconds, which was the quickest goal for Newcastle in Europe ever. Second goal, 9 minutes. Third goal, Scott Sellers got. Fourth goal, 50 minutes, Lee again. The only magpie to score a European hat-trick. And Terry McDermott said after that game, he said, we massacred them. I played in three victorious European Cup sides for Liverpool. But as a one-off, he says, that performance by Newcastle and Antwerp just topped absolutely everything. And he even survived, without going into any detail, because it's well known, he even survived the Woodhullock years at Newcastle.
He certainly did. And I guess a lot of people, John, would say, why does he get ahead of Kevin Keegan in your list? Is it the longevity that he was here at Newcastle? What's the reason?
Well, first of all, it's built. All this is on the Newcastle career. He was at Newcastle in age. He played for Newcastle in the Premier League. He played for Newcastle under Kevin Keegan, under Kenny Dalglish, under Rod Hullett, under Bobby Robson. So he was there in eternity. He won all his England caps with Newcastle United. Kevin Keegan only played two seasons with Newcastle in the second division in one now, apart from promotion, and that was from third place. It wasn't from winning the title if the second division. And if you were comparing their full careers, Keegan would be above Wobbly in their full career. But if you're comparing their Newcastle careers, then Wobbly, you know, hat-trick in our first game in Europe for 20 years, survived Rod Hullett when he was squeezed out because he was Shearer's best friend and wasn't even given a squad number, and then is brought back into the fold by Bobby Robson and plays in the semi-final of the FA Cup at Wembley for Bobby's side against Chelsea and scores the equaliser, and I thought we were going to the final, and then Gus Poyet scored again and we lost. But, I mean, he did so much for us. It's the Newcastle United number sevens, he did three times as much as Kevin. If it was career number sevens, they would be flipped.
Yeah, and Kevin's one. I guess the other important question is, John, because Rob Lee is well known for a wonderful pass to Alan Shearer when Alan Shearer side-foots it into the back of the net against Aston Villa. I'm sure you guys all remember it. Now, the big question, John, and when I bumped into Rob a few weeks back, this is the question I asked him, is that goal fondly remembered because of Alan Shearer's finish, or is it fondly remembered because of Rob Lee's 40-yard pass?
And Rob Lee said?
He said it's the pass. He says Alan's got different ideas, but he said it's definitely the pass. What do you think?
I think it's remembered for the goal, because the fans always remember goals, and Shearer Mid's got 206 of them or whatever it is. But it ought to be remembered for the pass. The beauty of the whole thing was the pass, not the finish. But goal scorers, you know, they get all the credit.
But hey, goal scorers are only as good as those assisting, and Rob Lee definitely knew how to ping a pass. And,
wonderful. I mean, his use of the ball was absolutely exquisite. He could finish as well, you know. He could finish. If everybody's got something wrong with him, and if there was something he didn't quite have, it was pace. But neither did his mate, Alan Shearer, and look at the career he had. But he had ability, and he's passed it on. I mean, two of his sons, Elliot and Ollie, have both played in the Football League, and Elliot is currently starring in that Hollywood extravaganza that's happening at Wrexham. And Rob is able to look after his life there. I haven't made him number one because I'm doing a big show with him at the City Hall in August, which I am doing with him. There's just the two of us. That'll be a lot of fun, but he might just buy me a drink as he's got to number one. But he's got it on merit. I think he was a super, super, super player. And we've had some good ones in our time, and it's fabulous. And you know, your list and my list, there'll be a few hundred out there preparing their list. And you know what? They'll all be different.
Yeah, we hope you guys are getting involved in, like we say, Rob Lee, number one in John's list, 381 appearances, 56 goals in total for Newcastle United. And had I done it on players I'd seen, John, he would have been top of my list. We did a little thing in the office here where we were talking about the best centre midfielders. And young Aaron picked Yohan Gabay ahead of Rob Lee, which I couldn't quite believe was the case. You know, for me, you know, you'd want to see Rob Lee alongside Bruno Guimaraes if we were talking about picking aside from the last 35 years or so. Them two in the middle would be the pair, and that is why
I'll have to give Aaron a little smack next time I see him for putting Gabay ahead of Rob Lee. I presume that Aaron didn't see Rob Lee, did he?
No, he didn't. Because he would have been, well, he would have been five, we would have been five, six, seven, or eight. He's not that younger than me, and I've got good memories of Rob Lee, so he's just got better memories of Yohan Gabay somehow. But I have admittedly got Rob Lee fourth in the list, but I mean, my list is, I say, done on kind of achievements and impact. And look, he was here a decade. If it was based on players I'd seen, he'd be top. But I've got Kevin Keegan ahead of him just because I've heard the stories and read the stories about the impact that Kevin Keegan had kind of off the pitch as well as on it in that short space of time. But if it was done on ability, on who I've seen with my own eyes in black and white, he'd definitely be top of that list. But he is top of your list, John. Second is Kevin Keegan. Third is James Scott. Fourth is Tommy Walker. Fifth is Len White. Sixth is Joe Linton. Seventh is Jock Rutherford. Eighth is Jermaine Genius. Nine is Jimmy Boyd. and 10 is Stuart Barraclough. As we say, Rob Lee, top of the greatest number sevens of Newcastle United, picked by our very own John Gibson. If you guys want to get in touch and tell me whether you agree with John's list, agree with my list, or you've got your very own list, or if we've missed out anyone very important, do let me know. You can get in touch at the EIBW podcast at reachplc.com. We hope you guys have enjoyed it. If you're watching on YouTube, give us a thumbs up, hit subscribe. If you listen on the podcast channel, thank you as always. Leave us a rating and review. And for myself and John, we'll see you guys very soon.